This is Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose Aguilar, who is coming back on the 11th. We'll be so glad to see Rose. We're followed by advertising everywhere we go. We're exposed to thousands of ads and marketing pushes every day. But the game has changed since about 2000. We have ad blockers. We stream content that doesn't have ads. Marketing has taken over where traditional ads used to rule. And the way it succeeds bears remarkable resemblances to how cults attract and keep their members. That is what the new book, Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults, by Dr. Mara Einstein, is about. She knows from ads as a former marketing exec for NBC, MTV, Miller Lite, and more. Nowadays, she's a professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. The dark side of advertising is also on display in her earlier books, Black Ops Advertising and Brands of Faith. In Hoodwinked, she probes the way companies weaponize psychology to maximize their profits and how we can steer clear of those traps. You can learn more at her website, Dr. Mara, that's M-A-R-A, Einstein.com, DrMaraEinstein.com. And by listening right now, of course. Mara, welcome to Your Call.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
So am I. And I have to tell you, I was looking forward to it as soon as I read the preamble to your book. I thought, this woman is a character. And I want to get that flavor right out there to the audience. You'll have to clean it up for radio just a little bit. But can you read that brief preamble?
Sure. I was participating on a panel at the Institute for the Future, nestled in Palo Alto, the home of Stanford University and the heart of Silicon Valley. The rest of the lineup was a band of brothers, trailblazers in the creation of the internet, dressed in that I'm wearing jeans and a wrinkled shirt, but I have a bucket ton of money way. I was the only academic among the group of presenters. I explained that the online space had become deceptive because it was filled with advertising that didn't look like advertising. Branded journalism was spiking, like Shell Oil paying for a story about sustainability, or Discover Card touting the value of a college education because marketers wanted to sell students on credit cards with high interest rates. This was the real fake news. One of my fellow panelists leaned over and whispered, "It wasn't supposed to be this way. We were trying to create community. We just didn't know. I'm so sorry." I leaned back. "You're still going to hell." That's how we start.
Certainly opens one's eyes. Well, you know, and I think it brings up immediately the fact that what we're about to talk about with marketing and advertising doesn't actually individually speak to the people involved. An individual person can work for marketing, can work for a computer corporation or a software corporation, whatever, and be part of what turns out to be a scam of sorts without individually intending it to be that way.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because for this book, I interviewed several marketers. I was particularly interested in marketers who are working with influencers, but I also talked to marketers who worked at multi-level marketing companies, and we can talk about that. But when I interviewed them, I did not tell them what the name of the book was because I didn't want to steer them in a particular direction. But when I did tell them that the subtitle of the book was How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults, they all said, yep, that's what we do.
Wow.
Now, some of them said, yep, like, yeah, obviously that's what we do. And some of them were like, that's what we do. And when we're not quite so sanguine about it.
Yeah, I want to talk about your own trajectory because this is the world that you inhabited. You were in marketing. And I've got this vision of Saul on the way to Damascus and he's struck by light. He's like, I see the error of my ways. Is that your story?
And actually, some people may know me. I was just in the Netflix documentary By Now, The Shopping Conspiracy. And in that documentary, it's a whole series of marketers who sort of had that, come to God moment when you're like, oh my goodness, what I'm doing is so bad for the planet and the world. And I was one of those folks. And for me, how it happened was I had have an MBA, went to a top school, started working in advertising, worked on all these different brands, and I learned the business. But I had always wanted to work in entertainment. And so I switched over and worked at MTV Networks and then moved over to NBC. And after 5 years of working in marketing at NBC, it was just really, one, it was really sort of mind-numbing. Because you see the same things over every year is exactly the same. But it was also that as a marketer, you see research because you see tons and tons of research because you want to understand what trends are going on, trends in terms of people's psychology, trends in terms of what people want to buy or watch or listen to, and so on. And I just remember being at, they have what are called the upfront meetings. And these are the meetings with where we bring in like 800 advertisers to see all of the new shows that are going to happen in the fall. And I remember thinking, you know what? I really don't care whether or not Jerry Seinfeld shows up. And I was like, okay, well, if I've gotten that point, okay, one, that's time to get out of Dodge. But it was also that I felt like this cannot be the best use of my energy on this planet to get people to watch more television. I mean, that just cannot be it. And so that's when I decided to go back to school and get my PhD. And in doing that, I knew I always wanted to do something around marketing and religion or media and religion. And I sort of came on that, not with my dissertation, but with my second book, which was Brands of Faith. And so that has become the trajectory for me to begin to understand that marketing and religion are not so very far from one another. And they use the same sort of methodology to bring people to faith, whether it's a religious faith or a brand. And what has happened with the introduction of digital technology is that it's not just a religion, but a cult.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because you mentioned that a lot of this goes on with social media influencers, which we'll get into in depth. But there's a quote in that section of the book that I think encapsulates this concept of marketing as cult indoctrination. Their need for income, referring to the social media influencers, and advertisers' desire for eyeballs, and the platform's mandate to generate revenue depends on you being reeled in to spend more time online than you should, all in the hopes you will buy things you probably don't want or need. And that's the guts of both marketing and cults. They draw you in, they nail down your attention and your sense of self, and at that point you're open to doing things that if you had more time to think and in other circumstances, you would see your way out of.
Right. Absolutely. And I think one of the most dangerous things about cults and brand cults and marketing generally is this idea that I won't get pulled in. I'm too smart to be pulled in by a cult. But the fact of the matter is there are smart people that become part of cults, and people who are part of cults are not stupid. And the way that cults bring people in is they target them when they are at their most vulnerable. And so the example that I give is college campuses freshman year. You have students who are coming onto campus who don't know anyone, who don't have a support system, who are trying to find their place in the world. And then someone comes up to them and says, do you want to go to a meditation class? Or do you want to have college students free dinner? Right. And then the next thing you know, they've been pulled into this group who starts telling them how wonderful they are. And more they start buying into that, the more they get pulled into the group.
In fact, it was interesting to see you in the book go right from
describing how cults work and a very thorough introduction to the book, and to go right into marketing of universities and colleges. And yes. It sounds an odd link, but it's not just the advertising and the marketing. It is the universities and colleges themselves engaging with that psychology, engaging with the students, making them feel special, you know, all but sending them teddy bears. And they're very smart about not only getting a student in per se, but how many students they reach out to, what percentage of the students come in, all of which comes into their marketing.
Right. And I think that a lot of people may or may not know that the people who are the marketers at colleges now, this college now is not your dad's university. It is an entirely different animal, particularly when it comes to the administration. And so for some top colleges, look, Harvard is going to be Harvard, and Harvard's brand is safe, more or less. Well, I won't leave the lawsuits aside. But there are colleges that have chief marketing officers who are coming from brand companies, who are coming from places like Pottery Barn, who are coming from places like General Mills, who know the psychology to use in order to be able to get people to desperately want to be part of that brand. And nothing says something about who we are these days, particularly for young people, is as what college they are going to. Because the first thing they do, right, if it's Ivy Day, you go on to social media on Ivy Day, and all of them are sitting in front of their computers pretending to open the email and find out whether or not they got in. And all of that becomes free marketing for the university. University doesn't pay for that, right? And they get all these kids saying about how happy they are to get into these schools. But the reality is you don't have to go to an Ivy League school in order to be able to get a really good education. One of the things, ways to think about this, the number of tenured faculty members in the United States, I think when I started about 25 years ago, was at around 37 to 40%. Now it's down to about 22%. So only 22% of full-time faculty are either tenured or tenure-tracked, which means that they're spread out all over the country. So go find a tenured faculty member who teaches what you want to learn and go to that university, whether or not it's got Harvard on the side or the University of Nebraska, which recently used to pay people to go to school there.
This is Dr. Mira Einstein. We're talking about her book, Hoodwinked: How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. You know, almost immediately in the book, you introduce us to one concept that bridges advertising and cult grooming, and that's the promise of community. And we're hearing a lot these days that we're in a loneliness epidemic. So tell us, pick a brand for me and tell us about how that brand leverages or sells community, what it looks like, how they make that feel.
Well, there's a couple. There's good cults and bad cults, because that's also what I want to say in this. Our definition of cults has changed, and I'm sure we'll get to that. I also want to say there are some cults that can be healthy, and there's cults that are really not healthy. And I talk about both of those in the book. So a cult that might be healthy might be something like the Nike Run Club. If you're already a runner and you want to continue that practice and you feel the support of the group because you are connected to those around the world. It also has training things for you, exercises you can do, but training runs, how often you should run. I mean, that could be something positive for people, keeps them on track, as it were. Something that would be less positive would be something like a multi-level marketing company, which when I asked a multi-level marketer and a cult expert, if you had to create a Venn diagram of an MLM and a cult, what would it look like? And they both said it would look like a circle, meaning that they're one and the same thing.
Right.
So what happens in a multi-level marketing space is that somebody who is already part of the group targets somebody online, asks them, usually it's in a social media space, and they'll say, oh, you're really good at this. Or somebody on Facebook you went to high school with suddenly contacts you. This is a popular one. Oh, I haven't seen you in a long time. How are you? You're really wonderful, blah, 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 blah. Oh, I just happen to be selling X, right? And they want to bring you on board. So the next part of that is the people who tend to connect with something like a multi-level marketing company are doing it again because they're vulnerable, because they need to make money. They may be a stay-at-home mom and aren't able to leave home. And so they think this is the answer to their money problems. And so somebody's telling them how wonderful they are. The first thing they do is they also make them part of a group chat. So they bring them into the community really, 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 really quickly. And what happens is that community helps them, quote unquote, helps them to sell. Usually it helps them to bring in other people. But what they learn over time is that if they're not living up to the expectations of the multi-level marketing company, you start to have issues in terms of toxic positivity because the people who are in the company will say, you're not doing this hard enough. You're not working hard enough. You're not being positive enough. You're not telling people how wonderful this is. And so that when people finally get to the point where they say, you know what, I can't do this, and they want to extricate themselves from the community, on the one hand, they may have already separated themselves from anybody else in their life. So their family is gone, their friends are gone. And the only community they had were people who were in the MLM. So when they want to leave, it becomes very difficult because they don't have someplace else to go. And what they also find out is the multi-level marketing people make it hard for them to leave. They tell, you know, they say, oh, you won't be part of the group, and you let your sisters down and things like that. And that is fundamentally the same sort of things that cults do.
I want to go more deeply into multi-level marketing, but something that applies in both that and in cults, which I do invite you to define for us, and you know, a lot of what you discuss in the book, it comes down to this sentence: being vulnerable to manipulation is predicated on the fact we have come to accept anxiety as our default state of being. That's grim. Why is that true?
Well, when you talk to people, economists, about the time we are living in, they say we are living in an attention economy. I think that's too polite because what they are saying is that the way that social media makes money is by keeping us connected to our phones. Therefore, the longer time we spend online, the more time we start scrolling through social media, the more ability they have to sell advertising to us. But I think that's too gentle. It's not just our attention, because then we could put our phones down, right? It's not that. It's that they ratchet up our anxiety and our anger in order to keep us connected to the technology. People may know this as rage farming. And this goes back to what you mentioned, Angie, earlier on in terms of influencers. It has to do with how influencers are incentivized. And they're incentivized to keep people connected and connected to them. And the way they do that is to have more outlandish and anger and anxiety-inducing kinds of content because people will stay connected to them. That's not good for us, but that's really good for them, and it's really good for marketers. And so that's why I argue that we are living not in an attention economy, but in an anxiety economy. And it's not just influencers, it's in the design of the technology itself. It is designed to have you stay connected to it. And some people may be aware of this idea of intermittent rewards, and that it works the same way as a Las Vegas slot machine. Sometimes you're going to get something you want, and sometimes you don't. And because you don't know whether or not you're going to get that thing that you want, you keep coming back. You keep coming back. And so you may get a notification, and you think, oh, maybe it's a text from a friend of mine, or maybe somebody liked one of my posts. And you may get that, but you may not. If you don't get it, you'll keep scrolling. And the technology is designed for that to happen, for that you will stay connected and keep looking. The other thing that the sites do, social media sites do, is they hold back your likes and then do a like dump so that That's another way for them to keep you connected to the technology.
It really is a slot machine. It's just a slot machine.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm curious about is psychologically, we can be aware of this. I mean, I've covered things like this. I know about dopamine hits. And yet, I keep going back to Blue Sky to see how many likes I got and to see how many reskeets I got. Why do we know better and still do it?
Well, exactly what you say. It's about the dopamine hit. And it's also about the fact that we have become so connected to the technology. I forget what the numbers are, but I think we pick up our phone, I want to say 151 times a day. I mean, it's really ridiculous. It has gotten so embedded into us as a habit. One of the things that to think about is that Steve Jobs, as much as people venerate Steve Jobs, there's no off button on your iPhone. Mm-hmm. There's no off button on your iPad. You have to consciously push the two buttons and then slide the thing across. But he purposely did not put an off button on that technology. And that was because he wanted you to have your phone on 24/7. He wanted you to not separate your life between your work and your play. And so if you're feeling like you're in this hamster wheel, you are. And some of the best ways to get away from that, one, turn off your phone at night. Don't put it by your bed at night. And if you don't have to walk around with your phone, and I realize some people do for safety purposes or whatever, just try practicing not having your phone next to you all the time. And what I also say to people, a way to think about it is, if you're not thinking about your phone as a shopping mall or a 24/7 marketing research project, then you're thinking about your phone the wrong way.
What was it you said in the book? Something along the lines of, would you hit the share button if you knew it was a share advertising button? Something to that effect.
Right. Well, because that's really what it is. Is you know, Mark Zuckerberg, as more as, you know, love him or hate him, and I think most of people probably at this point do the latter, he knew what he was doing by using the terminology that he did on Facebook. It talks about Facebook as a community. I'm sorry, but you cannot have a community of 3 billion people. You just can't, because people can't, just don't know that many people. The people that we engage with on Facebook are our Facebook friends. Well, again, that tries to redefine what we think of as a friend. Most of us, if we're lucky, have a couple of friends that we can put on one hand that are really close friends. Those are the people that you would call if your parent died, if something happened to your child, if you were in trouble. They would be the ones that are at your house. Not the people that are on Facebook. Those are acquaintances. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the share button. Because it said if you know, exactly the part that you read, if it said something like, oh, here, let me forward this ad to you instead of share, you probably wouldn't do it. But the way that this is set up is for advertisers. And remember, all of social media exists first to last to sell advertising. That's what it's about. It's not to connect us. It's not to create community. It's not for us to be able to organize. It's about selling advertising. That's all that it is. And so they're gobbling up all our data and all of this information about us to be able to target this, the advertising and marketing to us in the best way possible. And so if that, the way also that it works is advertising called paid, owned, and earned in social media spaces. So what advertisers do is they can buy advertising, which nobody looks at, right? Because you don't look at banner ads or whatever and native advertising and all of that. Nobody clicks on that stuff. And then they have owned, which is the spaces they own, either their website or their social media pages, or earned. And what they want more than anything else is earned media. And earned media is media they don't pay for. Those are all the shares that you do. That's all of the sending information out to other people, the reposting and all of that kind of thing. And so the way, reason why advertisers want that is the most effective form of marketing is word of mouth marketing. It has always been that way. Mm-hmm. And so while you might look at something that is sent to you by a brand, you're definitely going to look at something if it is sent to you by your mother.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
You're listening to Dr. Mira Einstein. The book we're discussing is her new one, Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. I'm Angie Coro in for Rose Aguilar. She'll be back next week. This is Your Call. It's time to invite you into this conversation with a phone call or an email. The phones are open at 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. If you'd like to bring us a question or comment but don't want to bring it on the air, Kevin will jot that down. We'll bring it off air for you. If you prefer email, write us yourcall@kalw.org. We're watching for that, too. This is Your Call. We'll be right back. It's Your Call. I'm Angie Coiro talking to Dr. Mira Einstein. The book is Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. You know, we talked about the ginning up of anger as a way to keep you coming back. I'm just curious psychologically about that, and I'm thinking of opiates. Opiates make you feel good, and opiates make you want to come back. Why capitalize on anger and fear and anxiety?
Because anger and anxiety needs release, right? And the ultimate goal of all of this, as I was talking about before, is advertising. And advertising is about getting you to buy something. And so what happens with the anxiety cycle is it's anxiety, doom scroll, anxiety, purchase. Mm. And the way that this works online is anyone who works in marketing knows about the marketing funnel. And so the top of the marketing funnel is awareness. You get people to know about your product. The second step in that is consideration. Is you want people to consider your product. So as people start to come in to understand what your brand is, what your product is, what your values are, they start to think about that might be something they would want to buy. Then the next step in the process is what's called conversion, which I think is funny. It's that's when somebody buys it. They've converted to being a purchaser of the product. Mm-hmm. And then the last stage of that is to become a loyalist, and what today we would call a marketing evangelical. Now, in the olden days, before social media, there was space and time between moving from awareness of a product to the time that you bought it and were an evangelical, because you might say, oh, you know, I see a commercial for, you know, a pair of Timberland boots. And then you might think, oh, you know what, I could use some of those. And then you have to get in your car or go down to town or whatever. You go to the store, you look at the shelf, and then you look at them and you're like, you know what, I'm not sure I can spend that much money on boots right now. And then you don't. Mm. But the way that it works online is the technology is created for you to think really fast, right? Daniel Kahneman's idea of thinking fast and slow. You want to think fast. You want to think with your emotion. Anxiety gins up your emotion. So you're thinking with emotion. You're not thinking with your intellect. And what happens in that space is the marketing funnel collapses so that the time from awareness to purchase can go as quick as a button.
Mm. We're going to go to the phones. Pete is calling in. Oh, Pete's from Tampa. Pete, thanks for listening out there. And you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for letting me on. And I want to say your guest, I'm so glad. It's like I'm tagging up with sanity from what she's saying, because so what I told you, screener, I swear, in 1984, way back in 1984, I turned 20 years old, but I caught a virus. I went blind in 1984. And what all I'm saying now is it was so much easier in the 1990s and 80s. And in other words, in the last 20 years, I don't know where I am. I'm like Rip Van Winkle. I don't know what people are talking about.
Oh.
And the ethos, the ethos of this world is wacky. And so everything you're saying is like, yes, I've been saying that for years. You know what I mean? And you talked about the type of marketing.
The MLMs, multi-level marketing.
MLM, I'm like, you didn't say it, but that's Donald Trump. And I'm like, how can you like Donald Trump? It's like everyone's like, it's great. Just come on board. It reminds me totally like Amway. It's like the same thing. Are you selling me Tupperware or what? You know, it's the same. That this mentality. But not only that, when you're talking about the social relationships that people are having, it was so much easier. I could walk down the street. People were so much nicer. And now they're like, you get on a train, whatever. People aren't even, they don't even say hello. It's like, what's wrong with everyone? What are you looking at? I don't understand the appeal of the technology. I'm just, Rip Van Winkle, and I've woken up to a world I don't like and I don't recognize. And, you know, it doesn't seem like the other people out there are having a great time. I'm like, I want to say, hey, you sighted people, are you in paradise? You don't sound like you are. I certainly don't like it.
That's an astounding perspective, and it's very special to hear that from you. Yeah. So thank you for that. Yeah. Your thoughts on that, Mira?
A couple of things. One of the things that we haven't talked about yet is this idea of in and out groups. And that's certainly one of the things that cults tried to cultivate, as it were. And that's the way that groups define themselves is by who they are, but also by who they're not. And in social media spaces, what happens is that we have been siloed so that we only interact with people who agree with our belief system. It used to be that we would talk to other people, right? We would talk to people who didn't agree with us. We don't have to agree on everything, but you know, you talk to people. Now it's, you know, everybody's, you know, your MSNBC or your Fox or your whatever it is. And so we don't have as broad a perspective as we used to have. And this is also why someone like Stephen Hassan, who's a major cult expert, talks about the fact when people think about cults, they think about having to go away on a compound somewhere. This is why we don't have to have compounds anymore, because the technology has siloed us already in such a way as to not deal with people who are going to disagree with who we are. What I'm also seeing in my college classrooms is my students starting to say, we're getting off social media. And one of the things that I also write about in the book is, and I've actually, I'm actually on TikTok, if people want to find me there, but one of the TikToks I created was about how social media is dying. And it's time to put a fork in it. It's partially because people are beginning to think it isn't as fun as it used to be. People who have been influencers, who have been on social media for 10 years. And if you're a big influencer, people are looking for you to post every single day.
Yes.
And they're getting burnt. They are so burnt out, they can't do it anymore. And so they're moving on to other things. And so what we're seeing is a space where you're going to see a lot of folks like Mr. Beast, who is very big and has a huge following and is a celebrity. But I think you're going to see a falling out away from social media as we know it now. And some of that also has to do with changes in X, and some of it also has to do with changes in the philosophy at Meta and so on. But it'll be, and also Google lost a lawsuit. So an antitrust lawsuit.
Right.
So some of that may come into play in terms of all of that. But to the caller's point also, I do talk about Trump in the book. I talk about Alex Jones and Pizzagate and MAGA and QAnon and how they were able to flourish in these spaces because of the siloing, because of those in and out groups, because people don't talk to other people, but also because something like Influencers, early on, I talked about influencers as conspiracy theorists. One of the largest groups of conspiracy theorists, particularly during COVID, were these sort of new age yoga instructors who believed that anti-vax was the way because they believed that their body is a temple and they believed that you should do your own research. And so as a community, the yoga community was one that really fell into these conspiracy theories. Another segment that fell into this was that they began using the hashtag Save the Children. Yes. And so suddenly a large group of women started following and believing that that was the right thing to do as well, not realizing what they were falling into.
Another of our callers doesn't want to go on the air but wants to know, isn't Donald Trump purposely getting us to feel anxiety, therefore follow him?
Yes, he's definitely trying to get us to be anxious. I don't, he will be the release of anxiety for some people. He will not be the release for people who never bought into who he was, that a lot of people still buy into him as their source of relief after what has happened after the last 2 weeks is really fairly astonishing because there's very few people, unless you're a billionaire, that he hasn't affected already.
Yeah, I want to talk about I'll tell you what's happening in the book is that there's so many things that are interwoven. It's like trying to pull out a plate, you know, from a plate of spaghetti and get one noodle out and say, okay, let's talk about this now. But what is interwoven is the multi-level marketing and a religious fervor and the way that religion goes into social influencers and anti-vaxxers. So pulling all that apart, you talk about a group called Leadership Dynamics. And the participants there said they were beaten. They were made to eat rotten food. And most notably, they were forced to get into a coffin and to be strapped to a cross. And this is just an indicator of how religiosity comes into all this.
Right. Well, that had to do with an early multi-level marketing suit. And there were three big cases that the FTC brought in order to be able to define what multi-level marketing was and to define the difference between multi-level marketing and pyramid schemes. Mm-hmm. And so what they found in these companies was, in addition to multi-level marketing, they also had training companies, coaching companies. And we see this now too, right? We see all these people coming out and saying they're coaches, whether or not they have some kind of ability to be able to coach anybody in anything at all. But a lot of those are spiritual. A lot of those are, I wouldn't say they're religious based, but a lot of them are spiritual, sort of touchy-feely based, as far as that goes. But there were three cases. The one you're talking about, the name escapes me.
The Leadership Dynamics?
Leadership Dynamics, but that's connected to a multi-level marketing company. And then there was a Costco case, and then there was Amway. Mm-hmm. And Amway was the big case. And Amway was the case that defined what multi-level marketing would be going forward. And what some people may or may not know is Amway is tied to the DeVos family, like Betsy DeVos, who was the former head of education under Trump, in his first administration.
Right.
And so they came out of Michigan. And they were coming in front of the FTC, and the FTC brought the same exact case against Amway as they had in the two previous cases that they won. But what Amway had that the other two folks did not was that it was founded in Michigan, and this was shortly after Richard Nixon had left office, and who replaced him but Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was from Michigan. And so the founders of Amway, when they were in front of the FTC, had a meeting, about 43-minute closed-door meeting with Gerald Ford. And it was reported afterwards that the president was very well aware of the issues that Amway was having in front of the FTC. And so Amway won their case. And the way that they won was to say that they were actually selling products and not just having people become part of the quote-unquote pyramid scheme. And so that has become the way to define what a multi-level marketing company is, not just for the United States, but around the world, because people around the world look to us for these kinds of definitions. Now, does Amway work that way? No, the things that you could buy from Amway, you could buy almost anywhere else. Though I hear their laundry detergent might be different and better. But by and large, anything that you could buy from Amway, you could buy. Because multi-level marketing companies don't make sense in the age of overnight delivery service.
Yes.
And being able to get almost anything you want, almost anywhere.
Now, whoever imagined that Tupperware would be in financial trouble? That was unthinkable once upon a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking to Dr. Mira Einstein. You can find her online. I'm going to spell this for you. Dr. D-R. MARAEinstein.com. Dr. Mara, it says, Mara Einstein. She pronounces it Mira.com. Her many books include Hoodwinked, How the Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. You can also find her book, Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Sell, and Selling the Sacred Religion and Marketing from CrossFit to QAnon. More of our off-air callers, man, a lot of people don't want to go on the air today. I'm not quite sure why, but they do want to know. Talking about the marketing abilities and Trump, going back to Trump once again, will your guest discuss marketing and its power in political influence? Surely Republicans hired much better marketing firms than Democrats in the last election. To your knowledge, is that the case? Are they better at marketing?
No, what... They're better at they are better at messaging than Democrats. The Democrats, I won't say how bad the Democrats are. The Democrats are really awful at it. But one of the things that the Republicans did, and I do talk about this in the book as well, and something that has come out recently that people are now understanding what was going on, was the interconnection of the bro folks on podcasting and YouTube, right? And so what happens is, these conservative podcasters would invite each other onto each other's show. And so what that does is provide what's known as social proof. And so if you like one of them and you're like, oh, Joe Smith had, you know, Ben Shapiro on, I guess I should check out Ben Shapiro and he's probably a good person to listen to. And so they all validate each other as people that should be watched. And then they're all espousing conservative viewpoints. What also happens is they wrap their conservative viewpoints in, you know, sort of generic kind of content, but they sort of slip in the more negative, more misogynistic, more anti-Black, anti-immigrant kind of content along the way. But it sort of gets mixed up in this soup of content. Mm-hmm. So it just sort of feels like one other thing.
And it takes us back to the algorithm, because you talked to one researcher who decided to watch a Trump video on YouTube and all of a sudden started seeing recommendations for white supremacist videos. And the way you put it is each subsequent recommendation became increasingly more extreme.
Right.
That's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's Zeynep Tefeke. She's a wonderful sociologist at North Carolina. She's also a columnist for The Atlantic and The New York Times. And she, you know, has done this work. And it's and I've talked to people who work in this industry, too. They don't know how it works. I mean, this is even before we're talking about AI. Mm-hmm. And now we add AI on top of this, and it's even worse. They can't explain to you how the algorithm works. What they do know, particularly when it comes to YouTube, is that when they put the recommendations of what you should watch afterwards, 70% of the viewing that happens on YouTube comes out of the recommendations that they provide. So the algorithm is telling you what to watch.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's someone in your book that we've been talking about, the religion and the healthcare advice and the extremism. The latter part of your book with the extremism is stuff that keeps you up nights. Mm. Crystal Teeny kind of incorporates all of those. Tell us her story.
Yeah, this was she was one of these health and wellness influencers. And actually, you know, she's a really beautiful woman, and she had a lot of kind of beauty shots in her Instagram posts. And she became, you know, she became one of these conspiracy theorists. This is what's known as conspirituality, which is a combination of conspiracy and spirituality. And she was one of these people who said, you know, your body is your vessel. You know, she got into all this anti-vax content. And so she posted one video, which was, and her stuff before that was getting some traction, but not a lot. But she posted one thing on Instagram, and all of a sudden it took off. And it was all about anti-vax. It was all about QAnon. It was all about anger. So all of the stuff we've been talking about up until this point, all of those things that we're talking about anxiety, that's exactly what she was doing. It was the first time anybody really paid attention to her. And so what does she do? She says, oh, this is what's going to make me money. This is what's going to get me attention. Now, do I know whether or not she believed in this stuff or not? I don't know. But she stuck with it for about a year. She was posting this kind of anti-vax, do your own research kind of content. And then after it started to fizzle out, she went back to the stuff that she was doing before. Though she also added an MLM to her content. So she had she did the full round of cult/marketing.
Well, and that takes us to when you get to the conclusions of the book and how we might address all of this, that looks at one of the problems in this picture is that whenever we see these multi-level marketers or the social media leaders, they really don't, when something goes amiss and they fall down, they frequently get right back up and do just fine. LuLaRoe, as you mentioned, there was the documentary LuLaRich. And you would think that after everything that MLM was exposed to have been doing, it would have gone away. It hasn't gone away. Right. Crystal Tini has not gone away. It seems as though part of the problem in attacking all this is there's very little price to be paid.
Well, that's when, you know, it goes back to your caller from Florida, is that it is up to us. I mean, part of it is up to us. Look, if it was up to me, I would tell the government to eliminate Section 230. Section 230 is the part of the Internet Act that says that social media spaces are not responsible for the content that appears on their platforms. And I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. at the AG's office, and I talked to somebody who was in the consumer protection area. And I said, why don't they do this? And she said, they could push a button and fix this. They could push a button. They don't have to work hard to change this and make it right. But there's no willpower on Capitol Hill to fight this. So instead, what they do is they create things that will fix something around the margin instead of taking care of it. So as long as our government is not going to regulate how these platforms work, we need to do what we can to protect ourselves as much as possible. One of those things is to turn off your phone when you don't need it. I mean, and certainly in terms of news, I'm old enough to remember that we looked at news twice a day. You got up in the morning, you read the newspaper, you came home and you watched either the 7 o'clock news or the 11 o'clock news. But you didn't pay attention to the news 24/7, and there's really no reason to do that. Mm-hmm. Try to take even a day without your phone and see how much it does to sort of reset your mindset. And whenever you can, not have your phone next to you, don't have it next to you. And for gosh sakes, turn off the notifications, because once you pick up your phone, we know you will give up 23 minutes of your time. Yes. Minimally. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to pick up your phone, get ready to give up a half an hour of your day. And is that how you want to spend your time? Do you want to be waiting for Jerry Seinfeld? Or do you want to do something that's good for you?
I appreciate you putting it that way. Maurice in Oakland, I'm going to try to squeeze you in here. Can you make your point concise? And thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I wonder if your guests would agree with this supposition that this is nothing more than a continuation of E.L. Bernays, who was a cousin to Freud, who was the first consultant to the National Association of Manufacturing at the beginning of the 20th century, and a continuation of what Vance Packard described in the mid-50s as the hidden persuaders.
Yes, I'm definitely building on their work. The difference is that the tools that someone like Edward Bernays had available to him were so minimal in comparison, and that he was not able to tap into our brainstem in the same way. And so what he had available to him was the ability to make a big splash and then use word of mouth marketing in a certain way, right? Because everybody had more of a shared culture. But today it's more insidious because of digital media.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that we need large scale systemic structural change. And you talked a little bit about that with Section 230 and how to approach that. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering for those, you also talked about getting off your phone, which is critical. But for those of us who, while we're on the phones or while we're on the internet, if we're aware of the fear of missing out, we're aware of the in and out psychology, how might we utilize that for ourselves while we're waiting for the government to do something more powerful?
Right.
Is it just getting away, or can you do something while you're online?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think one of the best things that people can do is not to get on your phone when you're tired.
Right? Oh.
Because that's when you are most vulnerable. But it's usually, right, it's at the end of the day, you've cleaned up the dishes, the kids are in bed, you're like, sit down, okay, I'm going to take a little time for myself. You're exhausted, and then you go scrolling through social media. That's when you are going to be most vulnerable to the messaging. So if you can try and do it when you are not exhausted, that could be something that would be helpful for people to know. Also, be selective about who it is that you're following. You can try and see what you can do to cultivate your feed. And also, one of the things that people are doing are moving to smaller group sites like Discord, or they're going to sites where they are not being manipulated by the algorithm, like you mentioned, Blue Sky. And there's going to be more and more sites like Blue Sky, including ones that are video-based. And I think those are better for people to engage with instead of ones that are algo-based.
You know, I knew, Dr. Einstein, that once we started this hour, we wouldn't get to nearly scratch the surface. But there's so much in this hour and so much more in the book. And I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. This was terrific. Thanks.
Dr. Mira Einstein, she's been my guest this hour with Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. She knows about ads from her work at NBC, MTV, Miller Lite, and is now a professor of media studies at Queens College in New York. If you've missed any part of today's show or want to check out our previous shows, visit kalw.org/yourcall. Nina Kissinger helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for tuning in to Your Call.